Good morning and welcome to Hour 2 of Focus 580. My name is Rita Schulte, sitting in today for David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Technical director is Jason Croft. Our number, write it down because it's going to be a busy hour, is 217-333-9455. And if you're out of the area, 800-222-9455. With me today is Dr. Malcolm Hill, pediatrician at Carl Clinic. And before we begin, I'd like to repeat David Inge's caveat. All questions concerning the health of the children and families and the people you love are welcome. But you know, you just can't diagnose what you can't see. So keep that in mind. Take the information to your practitioner for follow-up. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Hill.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Now, you sent us a lovely list of things. Some of these things are in the news, and I know people are concerned about them. So let's start with the cold and cough meds for kids, because this is the season.
Well, it's interesting. I think these are very commonly used medications that are over-the-counter. Research over the last 10 to 20 years has really shown that they're minimally effective. And sometimes dangerous, especially with some of the combined products, because you're getting Tylenol with this or that. So you may have people that are actually co-administering Tylenol with Tylenol, which can be dangerous. So it's a little confusing. So the FDA Advisory Committee met in August of 2007 and basically made a couple of recommendations. The first is they really advised against using over-the-counter cold medications for kids under two, for sure. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the companies took those off the shelves. They also decided, it was not unanimous, but that kids under six probably don't benefit from cold medications as well, so they're advising against that. And I think that's pretty much been the stand with the pediatric department as a rule. There are probably a few individuals that do respond and benefit, but I think the vast majority probably don't. So it's, you know, it's an economic issue. It's a safety issue. And so we generally advise, you know, treating a cold like maybe your mother would 50 years ago, which would be, you know, tender loving care, fluids, chicken soup, a little nasal saline if you need it, but not a lot of medication.
And so how does this affect one of the plagues in our household was always ear infections until we found out that the kids were allergic to milk.
Right.
And pull that from their diet a little bit. How does that affect treating ear infections? Because that was always the first thing. Ooh, Benadryl, you know.
That's a good question. Actually, they did some really nice research. They've repeated this research time and time again. And cold and cough medications, antihistamines, do not prevent ear infections. They also do not increase the speed of healing. So really, no real value there. So if you're looking at ear infections, there's really not a whole lot you can do unless you can prevent colds. If you smoke, don't smoke around your children, obviously. And if you have allergies, take care of the allergies.
Watch out for those,
absolutely.
Because they'll get you. If, you know, and I know, notice a lot, we spend a lot of time in our household treating what we thought were infections that were actually allergies.
Until
we figured that one out, that was interesting. Which leads me to another question while we wait for our phones to light up. 217-333-9455 is the number to call to speak with Dr. Hill. How, when you have children that have a problem with milk products, where there's a there are benefits to take consuming milk because there's a lot of nutrients there, but there's a side effect that, that may make it not such a good thing. How do you deal with replacing those nutrients? Calcium was our big concern because they were both girls. Not that boys don't need it, but there's, you know, sort of a ticking clock on calcium in women.
Well, you know, milk is not an essential element of the diet. So with calcium, there's lots of different ways of approaching that. Unfortunately, there aren't too many foods that have a lot of calcium in them. Some of the broccolis do, but it's really calcium oxalate, harder to absorb. So most people have to take a calcium supplement. There's also calcium you can buy, which is, you know, basically a tablet form. There's orange juice, actually, in some of the juices with calcium and, and vitamin D. So those are other sources. But if you're a female that needs a lot of calcium, you're probably going to have to take a calcium supplement, or be a tablet or something.
And even small, you can find those that are acceptable to little digestive systems.
Chewables, yes, you can. There's also, you know, fortified soy milk and rice milk and some other things for the real little ones that you can use that have calcium and vitamin D.
Because it can be a real challenge, and that's just a simple thing. It's not like you know, wheat allergies, mm-hmm. which cause real problems.
Right.
But
and if you're lactose intolerant, you just deal with the lactose. Yeah. Which is, you can still drink milk, but
right.
you have to deal with the lactose.
Yeah, just keep
sugar.
The drops on hand.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
We have a caller on line number 4 from Paris. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
I've got a question for the doctor. Mm-hmm. He was talking about cold medications in children. My daughter has a little girl that's just almost 2 and had a bout with coldia here a while back. Was doing a lot of coughing, and I told her, you know, the alarm's going off about the cold medication. And she said, well, what am I supposed to do, Mom? Just let her cough? And I said, well, Andrea, I don't know. I never dealt with this before. When you guys got a bad cough, we gave you medicine. Now they're saying no. So what is the doctor's advice if you have a small one, then she's crooping pretty hard and seems to be pretty doggone miserable? Do you just let them cough, or what do you do?
Well, I'm just going to refer back to the research that was done. They kind of compared things like water with cold and cough medicines, and actually water was equal or better in a lot of the studies. So little sips of water, humidified air. If you have a lot of nasal drainage and you're careful, you could do gentle nasal suctioning with nasal saline. And,
oh, okay.
And that may help some. Now, if you have smokers in the home, obviously that's an issue.
Yeah, that's not an issue here.
Okay. And if you have a really bad cough with a cold, certainly if it's lasting longer than 7 to 10 days, you probably ought to check that out and have somebody take a listen and a look.
But if it's just gone on for a couple, 2 or 3 days?
Well, it's probably normal. There's a lot of croup going around, so barky cough, that's where the humidified air and fluids come into play, unless they're having trouble breathing. You know,
just don't give them the cold medicine. Period, then.
Yeah, that's my advice, and mm-hmm. I think that's what you're going to find probably most people, as far as advice is concerned, giving
what
you
about,
that kind of
advice. What about, like, the old Vicks, you know, where we used to put a little Vicks on the side of their nose and a little bit on their chest? What's the call on that?
Well, that's probably one of those things that you can try. I just don't have any information on that.
But they're not saying not to use it.
I don't believe so.
Good. Okay. Well, that's what I had told her. I said, well, you could try a little bit of Vicks, maybe. That, you know, that might open her up a little bit.
Sure.
But I was just kind of really confused on what kind of advice to give her. You know, the old mom advice they're throwing out the window.
I know.
We're flying blind again. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye. It makes it tough for Dr. Mom trying to sort mm-hmm. out, because I was thinking about that the other day. I mean, my grandmother had a war chest of stuff and a lot of it had to do with most of life was centered around herbal teas and mm-hmm. Vicks on your back. Mm-hmm. And I wonder mm-hmm. if just remembering how some of that was done, we were tipped a little bit upside mm-hmm. down. And I wonder if it was the massage more than anything else,
it
or just being being held in a different position.
Exactly. Sometimes the drainage is an mm-hmm. issue. So
yeah.
It's, you know, I think physicians and people like to write prescriptions and give advice and all that. So it is a little difficult sometimes to convince people, but really, best we can tell, some of this stuff that's out there is really just not helpful. And
mm-hmm.
it's best to avoid for now. So
Knowing
that the kind of the normal course of a cold is important too. You know, respiratory viruses that cause colds, they cause symptoms for 7 to 10 days easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're having symptoms that go beyond that, consider allergies or consider mm-hmm. Secondary infections like sinus infections or things of that sort. But, you know, kind of just wait it out.
Uh-huh.
You know, people also have had this, opinion that green, yellow, runny nose is abnormal. It's an infection. It's all part of the cold.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally normal. So you can put up with that for 7 to 10 days. It's
mm-hmm.
okay.
Okay. Ugly is the operative
mm-hmm.
word. I know that in the building here, the adults have been bouncing around a wicked, wicked chest mm-hmm. cough. I mean, mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago, we all sounded like Airedales in here. I was talking about barking. What? You know, it's been a while since I've been in the having little kids in the house business. And I noticed that there are a number of vaccinations that are now being recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Things like pneumonia vaccinations mm-hmm. and chickenpox vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And are they doing what they need to do to keep kids healthy? Are they effective?
Well, yeah, I think mm-hmm. they have to be proven to be effective before they'll be licensed.
Okay.
So there is definite proof. Mm-hmm. For instance, the last 3 or 4 years we've been immunizing infants with the flu vaccine.
Mm.
And I think that's somewhat new, primarily because infants and old folks are more likely to end up in the hospital mm-hmm. or end up with complications.
Right.
And So we found that through following large populations of infants that, yes, it did prevent complications and serious illness. It didn't prevent the flu completely. So there's a good example of, you know, kind of following through on your immunizations, really seeing if they're effective or not, and then, you know, making your recommendations to large populations. And I think the same for chickenpox vaccine and some of these others. There's a really long laundry list of vaccinations now. If you look at the schedule, it's at first it was just daunting. It was just unbelievable, but I think people have gotten used to it, and it's really been very effective. We really feel that immunizations and prevention are the way to really go as far as healthcare, and that's immunizations are kind of a classic there. So,
well, because I know when our little ones, our daughters were little, there was DPT, and I think there was polio, and then measles came on board, and that was it. And you know, it was easy to keep them all straight.
Now we have hepatitis A, hepatitis B. We have pneumococcal vaccine for a certain type of meningitis. We have haemophilus vaccine for a certain type of meningitis, meningococcal vaccine. Interesting, I want to bring this up, though, that we still see a lot of whooping cough.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with that. And it's because we have a lot of adults and teenagers that aren't immune, so that they are carriers of this bug. And then they cough and transmit it to the susceptibles. And that's usually the source is either a mother or a teenager or someone with the cough that basically spreads it to an individual like an infant that becomes very ill. And now they have a new vaccine for adults that includes a whooping cough vaccine. So when you get a tetanus vaccine, I would certainly ask your doctor to at least consider using the DPT for adults. It's Adacel's the brand name. So if we can get rid of the if we can get rid of the adults and teenagers with the pertussis or whooping cough, we can eliminate the spread to the real susceptibles. And I think that's one of the strategies that we're starting to take now. But a lot of people aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, so. I think I met that shot when I had my physical.
Did you?
That came
Good.
As a surprise.
Good. Good.
Like, when was the last time you had a whooping cough, shot for whooping cough? Gosh, I don't know. Probably when I started
when you're
college.
Five? No, when you're five.
Okay.
Yeah, it has not been given to individuals beyond age probably five until just recently.
Oh, my. So there were just tetanus shots up to that point.
Tetanus.
And I had a pile of those.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was, you know, not the most careful kid. So one of the... That was on one of our lists of questions to ask was about that, because I think NPR did a little story a while back about how whooping cough was on the rise, and it was among adults and college students.
Yeah, this infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt did a study a couple of years ago where she took all the young people over like 16 that were to the emergency department with a cough greater than 3 weeks, and 30% of them had pertussis.
Wow.
Which was just hard to believe, but that was just one study, but it just shows you it's out there.
Well, another question that we were looking at, too, was ADHD symptoms and TV viewing.
Yes.
What's going on there?
What's interesting, there's been speculation that TV itself has contributed to the increased incidence of ADD. Studies were not really well done, a lot of information out there, but recently they did publish a prospective study where they actually monitored the kids in terms of how much TV they watched and what kind of TV they watched. And they followed these kids. They were under three, and there was a definite correlation in terms of ADD symptoms, not diagnosis, in terms of how much TV they watch, and the TV that they watched would be entertainment TV, which contributed, which would be videos, Disney, or video games, things of this sort, with rapid kind of screen flips and things of this sort, lots of action. And they really did find that there was a correlation. There was not a correlation between educational TV watching and these symptoms, though, which was interesting, like Mr. Rogers or Sesame Street or something like that. So what they need to do is really repeat these studies. They need to probably kind of separate groups for controls and things of this sort. But I kind of have been under the impression that kids spend way too much time watching TV. There's lots of issues. There's the obesity issue. There's the violence issue. There's inappropriate, material on mm-hmm. TV for kids, right. including the news,
yeah.
which they don't need to watch, especially young ones. And then there's the ADD issues mm-hmm. and things of this sort. So, you know, I think best advice would be to read to your kids. Mm-hmm. If your kids read, limit screen time for mm-hmm. now, certainly before age three. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think there's no harm in doing that.
Right.
Certainly advisable. Mm-hmm. And I promote that. So.
And I've got a question about that with ADD. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between children who have is this a learned behavior as opposed to a clinical issue, or is it all in the same brain formation
ADD? I think there's a strong genetic predisposition.
Okay.
I think they've shown that. They actually have been able to identify these neuroreceptors mm-hmm. and transmitters that actually are involved in certain cases. As far as environment goes, you know, it's a good question. I think this issue with TV may point to that as also a contributor. Mm-hmm. I think probably like most illnesses, there's a genetic component and an environmental component. Mm-hmm. And so if you have the right child with the right genetic makeup and throw them in front of a TV, maybe that's the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think there's probably multiple factors, but there's definitely a strong genetic predisposition mm-hmm. to ADD.
I guess I've always been kind of interested in the ADHD and ADD syndromes mm-hmm. together. How do you make the distinction between a kid that is just busy mm-hmm. and a child that is genuinely in trouble and needs different kinds of support yeah. other than just behavior modification?
I think you just really answered your own question. In
okay.
trouble.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So symptoms without causing any particular mm-hmm. Problem would probably not fit the diagnosis. You have to have some impact on your life to
okay.
really make a diagnosis. You know, some of this is degree.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a little bit of, you know, mm-hmm. restlessness. Everyone has a little bit of forgetfulness. But if it's to a degree where it impacts your life, mm-hmm. whether it be home, school,
okay.
social, then it becomes a disorder.
Gotcha.
So it's a matter of degree and also a matter of environment. I mean, if mm-hmm. I put one person in an environment where not a whole lot is required, the structure is adequate, they might do fine in that environment, mm-hmm. but you take and put them in another environment where they have to sit still, where they have to, you know, listen to long lectures, boring
right.
material and read, and that might be a problem. So there's a fit as mm-hmm. well that exists. But disorder meaning it affects the individual's function.
Okay.
So it's a hard diagnosis, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine that because if you're probably seeing a child at an intersection point.
Yeah, I think you have to get a lot of history mm-hmm. from parents, teachers.
Yeah.
People around the child, it has to be something that's consistent over mm-hmm. years, usually, before you would probably make a diagnosis mm-hmm. of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Because that would have to be a tough one.
It's difficult. There's really no good tests I can do. There's no lab I can draw. There's no mm-hmm. PET scans or MRI scans I can do to define the problem yet, even mm-hmm. though there probably will be. It's all clinical, so mm. it's difficult. You have to tease out a lot of information, and oftentimes I use other specialists mm-hmm. to gather information, psychologists and things of this sort.
So it really is important to pay attention to what's going on with the little people around you.
Pay attention, right.
Yeah, so, it's all about paying attention. Mm-hmm. I want to remind everybody that our phone number is 217-333-9455, and if you're out of the area, 800-222-9455. I've got I don't know if it's associated with ADHD or just that whole bevy of syndromes where paying attention is important, but how does dyslexia,
mm-hmm.
that's another tough one.
Well, I think dyslexia by the classic definition is difficulty with reading
mm-hmm.
or reading or interpreting the written word. Of course, that's a different phenomena altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can be dyslexic, whether you have ADD or not. I guess in this situation, though, kids with ADHD,
mm-hmm.
there's a higher incidence of learning disabilities,
mm-hmm.
including dyslexia. So that's how those tie in, I think.
Okay.
There's also a higher incidence of anxiety, depression,
mm-hmm.
Bipolar disorder, and things of this sort in individuals with ADHD.
So the sooner things are determined or diagnosed, the better to stave off some other things.
Yeah, I think with ADHD, if you make a diagnosis of ADHD or if you have a child with ADHD, you should be looking for the other problems because about 50% of the time there'll be something else going on that needs to be tended to.
Okay.
When it's a good rule.
Okay.
So
we have a caller on line number one from Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just tuned in, so I don't think you've talked about this particular question I have because it's a very general question, and it has to do with, I have two sons and two boys, and, you know, the car seat issue. I've just been getting a little concerned because it seems like their genitals are just being pushed by these car seats and smushed, and the reason I bring that up is just because I recall when I used to do a lot of bike riding, there were some issues with bikers having problems with all kinds of impotence and other issues just because there was just too much pressure on these bikes. And I wondered, is a similar situation going to happen with the kids? Are there any studies that point to that or long-term kind of studies that have seen, that have discussed that at all?
Actually, I've not seen anything that relates to that. I would make a couple of comments about how old are your boys?
One is 3 and a half, and the other one is 9 months. And here's the main concern with the nine-month-old is he's almost 30 pounds. So he's pretty big to begin with, and he's healthy as can be. He's very proportional. He's tall. He's big all around. So he seems to be even more squished than my other son.
Do you put the kids in their car seats with their coats on and things, or are they just like in just basically?
I have recently, yeah, because it's been colder, and, you know, even the car is cold when you get into it in the morning.
Okay. So a couple of comments. First of all, you know, of course, the size of the child really is, it matters in many respects, comfort, and also the car seats are weight and height limited. So check that out. Make sure you're within the limits of the car seat.
Right. We had to go to a bigger one, you know, like 4 ago.
I bet. And then there's adjustments of straps and things. So nobody should be uncomfortable in a car seat.
Well, that's what I was, so we do that. The only thing, it does seem if we loosen it up too much, especially for the month old, it's kind of on the top. Too,
right.
Because of the way the seat is, the way the mechanism works.
I would do a couple of things. First of all, it's probably better to put the kids in their car seats without a coat because it does add bulk and it doesn't allow you to really strap up well.
Okay.
Secondly, if you think there are problems with that car seat and the fit of your child or the fit in your car, I'm just going to put a plug in for the Safe Kids Coalition car seat checks. Susan Butler is the director. She's at Champaign-Urbana Public Health in Child Maternal Health, I believe, and she's an excellent resource. And I'd have those car seats checked out. There's really no way I can do this over the phone, and I think it'd be helpful to you, and you'll learn some things. I learned some things every time I talk with them. They're trained technicians. They've had, like, 4 days of training, which is unbelievable.
Well, I just wonder, you know, because the whole car seat phenomenon, and it's even changed from my first son, the mechanisms have changed, too. Like, they used to be just the strap, and now they have the 5-point
kind of
seat, and that seems to be even more concerned in that area. That's why, before I wasn't so concerned, and now I am more concerned.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be damage. I think you have to weigh the risks and benefits. Obviously, automobile accidents are extremely
Well, yeah, we're not going to stop
serious.
Putting them in the seat.
Yeah, and I think if it's not, if your car seat doesn't fit your child or your car, I think, first of all, have them adjust the car seat and set your car or your child. So there's different models, different, you know, kind of designs. I'd go in and talk with Susan or at least call and she can set you up with someone, okay?
Okay.
Susan
Butler. And then the other question, because it actually what brought up all this thing. So because he's so large, my second child, you know, the doctor has, the pediatrician's always said, now make sure you clean really well around his genital area because he's just,
a lot of folds.
Yeah, he's just got lots of stuff in there. So, but you know, when do we? If there's irritation, it looks red or pinkish, and then sometimes it gets really, really red. And I don't know if there's something. That's why I don't know if it's the car seat that's doing that, or if there's something else going on with him that is causing that area to be really red and almost look swollen?
It's probably not the car seat, but
okay.
I think just, you know, mild soap and water, airing the area dry, keeping loose-fitting clothing, and then if it looks really bad, have somebody take a look. So.
Okay, so you should. Okay, so really bad means if it's really red.
If it's not clearing up with your home measures.
Okay, yeah. With just the wipe. Okay, yeah. So that's what we've done, just mild soap and water,
yeah.
Kind of keeping the area clean,
okay.
And then letting it air dry. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay, well,
thanks
good.
For your question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Thank you. We have a caller on. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to make one other comment.
Okay.
Of course, booster seats are the next level. And
yeah.
I've worked with Safe Kids a little bit, and it's amazing how many people that really need to be in booster seats aren't in booster seats between 4 and 8. And actually, some kids that are even older still would benefit from a booster seat. So that's the other thing, too, that you might check with the Champaign-Urbana Public Health on is boosters and making sure that your kid's in the right restraint. So, you know, lap belts alone aren't going to be as safe, if you will.
Small children are just going to fly right out of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, the belt rides up into the abdomen, so they damage abdominal organs.
Mm.
The shoulder harness often comes across the neck, which is not your best situation. So,
well, speaking as a 5-footer, we've got a shoulder harness that comes right across the ear and the neck sometimes, too.
Not comfortable.
No, but I have noticed that if your car is relatively new, dealers can show you how to fix that.
Sure.
And you just have to remember to unfix it when the tall person in your life drives.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like one of life's little confrontations. Yes.
Right.
I want to remind you that the number to call is 333-9455 or out of the area 800-222-9455. And we have a caller now on line number 2 from Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I found your show really informative, and I have a granddaughter, 2 granddaughters in Colorado, and recently, well, when school started, Alex had called her Nana crying because they had given her 5 shots at one time, and she's, 11, and they gave her that shot already for the cervical, is it cervical cancer?
Right.
She was crying, and I told her mother, I try not to interfere, you know, you don't want to do that, but I thought that was way too many shots for one setting, and she got really sick, feverish, and, you know, for a couple of days was just really feeling bad. So my question is, when they give that many injections to a child, how can they tell if they have a reaction to one, which one it is? And well, do you agree that 5 is too many?
Well, I think they've looked at this, and in terms of effectiveness and safety, you can give all these vaccines together at the same time at different sites with a certain amount of space in between the injections. For a reaction, if it's a local reaction, we write down where we give the vaccines. We can tell whether the swelling is from vaccine A, B, or C. But if it gets down to fever, chills, rashes, you really would have difficulty sorting those things out, I think, retrospectively.
Oh, yeah. And I think I told her mother, you need to speak out. I mean, if you wanted her to have 2 or 3 shots that day and then go back in a couple weeks and have a couple more,
that's
a mother's choice, right?
That's acceptable. I think the problem in certain clinical settings is that we may never see that child again. Now, that's more likely to occur in my practice in Chicago in the South Side. Sorry.
Yes, I understand.
And in my practice, I certainly give parents an option. I don't have any problem with coming back and spacing them out because I know most families are going to do that. But some pediatricians really push hard on the immunizations, and it's not wrong. It's kind of actually suggested by the American Academy of Pediatrics to get it all done when you're there.
It does?
Yeah, I think. But, you know, you got to use your judgment. You have to work with people. And I think probably in your situation it would have been reasonable to split them up. But I can't criticize that physician for doing what's done in many places. And it's
do you think that she was too young for that one shot?
The vaccine for cervical cancer is called Gardasil.
All right.
And you can give it as young as 9. I think you certainly would want to give it before high school. And we're the I think the target age is 11, but it, you know, it's kind of a one of those vaccines that you can start anytime after 9. It's a series of 3.
And
you
want to really worried me.
Yeah, you really want to get that done before kids, you know, become sexually active. You know, it's just the facts of life. I mean, you hope that they don't, and you hope that they protect themselves, but at least this eliminates about 80% of the cervical cancer, which is just epidemic.
I wasn't aware of that. But
it's caused by the virus. It's caused by a virus that we can immunize against, human papillomavirus, and that's what that vaccine's for.
Mm-hmm. I have another question about, she is a gymnast.
Okay.
And her mother, wonderful with her on that. She's very tiny for her age. Does that, and we've heard this, but we didn't know if it's true, does that affect their menstruals?
How old is she?
She's 11.
Okay.
And she's been in gymnastics since she was 5.
Mm-hmm.
Does that affect hormonal growth at all?
It can. Heavy activity in girls where they actually have a limited amount of body fat can affect menstruation. It also occasionally can affect their pubertal growth. But this is only something that could be determined by serial measurements, BMI, body mass index ratings, and, you know, good physical. So at 11, it's not rare for girls to be prepubertal, you know, not to have entered puberty already. But it's something that can happen in dancers and gymnasts. And there's a little higher incidence of eating disorders in some other groups. But for the most part, most girls that participate in gymnastics are healthy. And they just need to be followed carefully. So,
One more question. I'm out of there, so someone else can call. When I was a child, I had 2 chicken pox shots, but they never took. They never blistered. They didn't do anything. The doctors told my mother that I probably had a natural immunity against that.
Well,
at my age now, in my 50s, is that anything I should go and get?
Well, I think you were talking about smallpox. We didn't have chickenpox vaccine.
Right. It was smallpox.
Yeah. And as far as smallpox goes, we're not immunizing for that anymore, primarily because it's been one of those diseases that we've been able to pretty much eradicate with immunizations. So I'll promote the immunizations again, including Gardasil.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you could certainly inquire, but as far as I know, there's no need to really do much there. So.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your advice. Thank you so much.
Alrighty.
Thank you. We have another caller on line number 1 in Champaign.
Hello.
Hello.
I, too, had some concerns about the new vaccination we have for girls at seems quite wonderful. But I have not been able to find any studies that included people below the age of 15. And for people who maybe have 6- and 7-year-olds, could we expect some research done on people younger than 15?
Good question. I don't. Well, the data that I have is pretty much that it's is effective for children 11 and older, but that's
it's not the efficacy that I was concerned about. It's the fact that they really didn't study anybody below the age of 15, and so I'm wondering. I'm about a 9-year-old, and of course that's not critical at this point. In our situation, but I think I at first didn't understand why people would hesitate for a minute. It's wonderful, but I too now would have reservations when I can't find a single study that tells me anybody below the age of 15. I mean, I don't expect that we can't have a long range outlook on something this new, but there's such a difference in individual development and all those kinds of things. I just have concerns, and I just wonder if the reason for not going below 15, maybe they can't get people to put their children in studies. I don't know. That is a concern for me, and I wonder if that we're going to see something that would give us information.
Well, I do believe there's some data there, and I can't really give it to you now, but I think if you we can contact the station later, I can certainly try to provide you with data.
But I can't find anything online
younger
people.
Sure. And I think some of it's not published yet. I think that's some of the problem with some of the studies that they do. They're not published yet, but the FDA has the information.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And as far as studying, what they're doing now is also studying boys. It's always been kind of a interesting phenomena. They want to immunize the girls, which certainly is obviously logical. But since the boys also have the same problem with the virus, they're transmitters of the virus. It probably makes good sense to immunize males as well when they get the data on it. As far as immunity goes, it's interesting too. Is that they've studied this in slightly older populations, women greater than 26, and the efficacy is not as good in women over 26. And they found, I think, the efficacy is pretty good in the younger. But I'll see if we can get that data for you. So,
Might it be because women over 26 may have already been exposed to the virus and it just doesn't?
No, it's just their immune system doesn't kick up as much as the kids.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Makes a certain amount of sense because most of the herd immunity is acquired by younger.
Yeah, I don't know. I think kids tend to be more immunogenic. They tend to be more reactive to infections and things of this sort. So maybe it's part of just the aging process. I don't know.
Wow.
So
then I shouldn't have to worry about getting some things.
Hopefully not.
So. Yeah. However, that DPT shot, we still have to ouch on that,
that
one.
Hurts.
Yeah, that did. You touched on something, and I'll give the phone number one more time, 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. Briefly, with girls in dance and gymnastics, where they're generally pretty healthy, a term went by that just kind of went by, and it was eating disorders.
And did I say that?
Not in association with that. It was just a word that kind of came out. And one of the things that I've kind of always wondered, there was an old saw in some baby book I had that a kid will eat from, you know, 2 to 4, about as much as they ate in 2 days before that. And that's reasonably normal, that, that you don't push and you don't make an issue out of it. But somewhere around 9 or 10 with little girls, something risky hits with eating disorders, and how do you deal with that one? That's an ugly one.
That's a difficult question.
Sorry.
I really don't have a pat answer for you. I think girls, for whatever reason, seem to be under a lot of pressure nowadays, whether it be media or parents or their own expectations of themselves. But you see a lot of girls becoming concerned about their body at that age, and that's some of that's normal. You know, kind of prepubertal development that occurs. But, I think basically as girls, mature, you hopefully can explain to them about, bodily changes, function, talk with them about nutrition, follow them through their teenage years. And if you detect that there are issues, certainly, dig a little deeper as a provider or a parent. It's not rare to have problems. And, I think we're all pretty much aware of this now.
But it's another case of observation and keeping
in
touch.
So. And, eating. And I think, the infants and toddlers often eat pretty well. And I think generally, we don't reinforce eating at that age. We don't reward it. It's like breathing, If you're hungry, you eat. You try to provide adequate nutrition. You don't let them make all the choices, but they should stop eating when they're not hungry, and you don't want to push it and, kind of reward. And I think generally as they get older, if they lose that drive, their body's telling them that they don't need the calories, hopefully. And that's, when they kind of just, look at their plate, and it makes everyone nervous. But if they eat one good meal a day, actually, and you follow their growth and, get their height and weights, if they're doing well, you try to counsel parents just to relax.
Yeah, back off.
Back off.
Yeah.
And I think that's important, but you can't let them make choices, you know, all their choices. You can certainly give them a range of, you know, choices, but certainly have to, parents have to kind of monitor what they eat, not how much they eat, I think, for the most part.
Yeah. And the flip side of that coin is the obesity epidemic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are we seeing in the United States, I mean, we can't speak for anything else, but the studies done in the United States on children, are we seeing increase in high blood pressure? With
seeing
that?
An increase in body mass index and weight, and we're seeing an increase in type 2 diabetes and blood pressure. Anything that will go along with that increase in weight, bless you.
Oh,
so,
thank you.
So, yes, it does affect health. And I think, unfortunately, it may carry over into adulthood, too. So we're going to have a bolus of people. And it has to do with lifestyle. I mean, if you looked at the number of fast foods people eat per week, it's gone up tremendously. Both parents working, busy lifestyles. Look at the amount of screen time, the lack of exercise. You know, I think there were two TV channels when I was growing up. Now there's like 480 if you get some of these boxes with, you know, it's just amazing. So I think overall it's going to be a difficult tide to turn unless we change something in our environment. You know, fast foods need to change. You know, I think activity level needs to pick up.
Because one of the things that we had noticed is the number of subdivisions going up here and in a lot of other places where we travel, and so many don't have parks in them.
Right.
Or even sidewalks.
Right.
And I can remember spending forever on my bicycle because my mother wouldn't let me even think about the street, but a lot of time on the sidewalk, and learned how to mountain bike on a regular bike because the park wasn't always that level, but it was some place to go.
It's interesting. You know, a lot of the cities, there's no place to play, but it's also maybe not safe to play.
And yeah, I think there's that.
And I think you see that around here, too. People aren't really comfortable just letting their child out in the backyard to play without, you know, really keeping an eye on them or whatever. It's just, people just don't feel safe now for whatever reason.
Yeah. You know? Well, I know that we meet a lot of people in and out as volunteers come in, and they have children in their lives either as parents or grandparents, and there is the feeling that it's a very predatory world out there, and people are now getting more and more concerned about letting their children out to play.
Absolutely.
And generally, you know, I haven't had a whole lot of time to even think about, is that real, or are we also being negatively affected? Are adults being negatively affected by what they watch on the news?
I think we all are. I think, you know, we have, you know, for instance, you talk about the methicillin-resistant staph.
Well, that one, yes.
About. You get the terms like flesh-eating bacteria, superbug, you know, and they report the worst possible case scenario, you know, where someone really has a major complication, whereas 99% of the, you know, staph infections are like impetigo when you go into the doctor or a little boil or whatever, even though they can be aggressive and should be treated properly. You know, I think the media just hypes everything to a point sometimes where I think you're afraid to turn around. You know, look at the stock market. You get reports every 15 minutes.
Every 15 minutes,
up and down. No wonder the stock market's going so crazy. So this information we get that's instantaneous, that's on the spot, you know, it has its benefits, but also I think it drives some things, you know, some anxiety in all of us.
So calm parents, do calm parents make for calm babies and children?
Well, I think it helps a lot. I really do. I think, you know, basically the kids pick up on parents' mood, their anxiety levels. So if I have a child with a minor tummy ache and a parent that's pretty worried about it, the tummy ache's a lot harder to deal with. It's harder to really diagnose appropriately sometimes, but certainly it's harder to really manage. So, yeah, and I think we all have that. We all worry about our kids.
Oh, yeah.
It's just anxiety does affect a lot of our actions.
One of the had an interesting conversation with one of my girls. She has gone down the chicken pox circuit now for the third time. Which, you know, this, and I thought, well, that, how did, in the world did that even happen? And I said, are you sure that it was chickenpox that you had? And she said, well, yeah. She said there was an infectious disease specialist, and when they saw her, it was all down one arm, a little tiny rash.
That was probably zoster.
And, yeah, and I was like, well, how do you get chickenpox three times? It didn't make a lot of sense to me, but not being in the biz.
Well, most of the time you really have chickenpox one time. Mm-hmm. But chickenpox is a DNA virus, and it stays in your body, actually. Mm-hmm. You fight off the infection, but it just stays dormant in mm-hmm. nerve roots. So it can re-erupt, but typically it re-erupts in one area one called dermatome where the nerve comes out. So you may develop a re-eruption along an arm, a trunk, a face. But it's not chicken pox where you have cough, runny nose, fever, multiple vesicles everywhere in your body. It's more localized, and they call it zoster or shingles.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Shingles.
Because she was counseled to get a shingles
A new vaccine.
At some point where they were pretty sure she wasn't popping some kind of to be very careful when she got it.
Right. And but you can take medication for that, acyclovir, and there's one other for zoster or shingles. So, it's interesting. It's a re-eruption.
Because she said the last time she saw a group of medical professionals back away from her as quickly as that is when she came in with pink eye, which is another, it seems like, you know, you could come in with something, a body part falling off, and the reaction isn't as strong as if you have pink eye. I mean, I understand that's a real evil, contagious thing
you're
something.
You're getting me started. No. Basically, conjunctivitis is inflammation of the superficial lining of the eye. It's very common. It is almost never dangerous or damaging to the eye. It's usually due to a mild virus or a very low-grade colonization of bacteria that causes mild infection. It's being confused with an adenovirus, which causes terrible hemorrhagic conjunctivitis and actually can damage the cornea.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, you know, people are kind of generalizing, including daycare, schools. You get a kid that has a little twitch, you know, just a little erythema to the eye with a little discharge, and all of a sudden, you know, they've got to be excluded from school, this and that. And it's just not, it's kind of misconception. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's at the state level, it's at the national level. These daycares and schools have to follow guidelines.
Right.
And it just hasn't been sorted out well, because it's really causing the child to miss school, the parent to miss work. Visits are expensive. Medication's expensive. It's really costly. So I've actually started talking to somebody in Chicago about this. And I think this needs to be readdressed. It's really not a big problem.
Really?
It's not. If you look at contagion and as far as a serious illness, no. It's not.
Because I cannot tell you how many days off.
I can tell you how much it's costing.
I agree.
It's very expensive for people. They miss work.
For something that's not going to kill you.
It's not going to hurt your eye, usually.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing how things tend to become.
Yeah.
Really.
I'm not sure. It's kind of like the momentum, kind of went forward, and now it's hard to back up again.
Yeah.
Almost, but we'll work on it.
Because I always wondered if it was one of those little vexing infections that if somebody in your house has a compromised system might be a real issue, but I don't even know about that. I just don't know.
Probably not any more than anyone else.
So that sneezy cold is, every bit as bad as the...
It's more contagious than that eye.
Yeah. Because the eye is not going to sneeze on anybody.
Right, exactly.
Okay. I guess I have time for one more question, and I've got so many I don't know where to start. But you had, you were talking here about the changes in the recommendations for antibiotics for people with heart murmurs, like a lot of prophylactic antibiotics for dental work and that kind of thing, I'm assuming.
Get a lot of calls for, I think, in the past, until 2007, we would prescribe antibiotics to individuals with structural heart problems, such as leaky valves or holes in the heart or whatever. And the antibiotics would be given prior to dental work where you get into the gums or surgery, of certain types of surgery, to prevent infection of the heart, which can happen when you get into the gums and do surgery. You put bacteria in the blood and supposedly it lands on the heart and sets up an infection. But after carefully studying this over years, they found that actually the incidence was so low that it's not really worth giving the antibiotics, A, because, drug resistance, B, because of individual reactions and allergic reactions. And so they've changed the guidelines. I'm not going to tell you specifically what they are, but you can talk to your doctor about it if you have any kind of heart problem that requires antibiotics, because you may be on the list to get to receive the antibiotics, but you may also be spared from that. So check with your doctor. The American Heart Association has the guidelines on their website.
Yeah, well, that's so probably a good idea.
It's really check it out.
Right.
Save you a lot of exposure.
Because if you could, if you need a lot of dental work, that could be a real serious...
Could be a real problem.
Lots and lots of antibiotics.
Right.
Because they don't stick in your system that long, I don't think, do they? Or I'm not sure.
Well, the antibiotics, I think what happens is you take a large dose one time to prevent the infection during the procedure, but it's still an exposure. And, you know, the incidence of penicillin allergy and anaphylaxis is going to be higher than the risk of any infection. So I think that's the point.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome.
And we've got 1 minute. So if you were going to tell me the best thing I could do in the cookie season, the sugar season, is to restrict it maybe as the little ones go into Christmas to kind of calm down.
Moderation. Don't bring it to my office, whatever you do. That's all I ask you. Don't bring food to my office. No, it's just exposure. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah, lots of stimulation there.
Exercise more and use moderation.
So, okay. Well, it's been great having you here.
Okay.
It's been wonderful taking your calls today.